Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. This week on the programme, we're exploring the Global Investment Returns Yearbook. The yearbook is the authoritative guide to historical long-run returns. Most recently published by UBS in collaboration with the London Business School, and prior to this, the Credit Suisse Research Institute, it covers all the main asset categories in 35 markets. Most of these markets, as well as the World Index, have 123 years of data, right the way back to 1900. The most recent edition demonstrates the combined strength of UBS and Credit Suisse as the integration of the two banks progresses, and also marks the continuity of a long-standing partnership with its authors, Professor Paul Marsh and Dr. Mike Staunton of London Business School, and Professor Elroy Dimpson of Cambridge University. To unpack some of the key findings from this year's edition for us, we are very fortunate today to be joined by Paul Marsh, by Bulletin regular Kieran Ganesh, Managing Director in the UBS CIO, and also by Tim Ramskill, Global Head of Product Management in UBS Investment Bank. And it is with Tim that we start. Tim Ramskill, thanks so much for being with us today. And perhaps set the scene for us on this amazing resource, Tim, first up. It's such an authority. Tell us a bit more about the 2024 yearbook. Why does it provide such a compelling narrative?
The yearbook has an increasingly long history. So whilst it focuses itself on the return characteristics across many asset classes, equities, bonds, cash, currencies, and inflation over 35 markets back to 1900, it's actually by happy coincidence the 25th anniversary edition of the work. So a lot of depth laid on top of a very, very long history.
We're going to hear from Professor Paul Marsh in a moment, but just give me a sense first, Tim, of how this edition, the 25th no less, as you've mentioned, has built up over that, well, over that quarter century.
I actually caught up with one of his co-authors, Mike Staunton, just the other day, who very kindly presented me with the first edition that they collaborated on back in 2000. And I think at that juncture, there had been very little work done truly on the return characteristics across different geographies. So most academic work up until that point had been US-centric in nature. And I think the three of them together wanted to really tackle whether the same characteristics that had borne out in the US were reflected across other geographies. And that kind of starting point of wanting to sort of tackle what was being missed, I think is truly at the heart of the yearbook. Chapter 10, given the 25th year anniversary, is quite a nice opportunity for Paul, Elroy and Mike to kind of really walk through how the work that's presented in the yearbook has built up over time. So that's been a combination of adding additional markets, adding additional asset classes, tackling additional topic areas. And the 2024 edition of the yearbook is no different in that regard. So for the first time, the three have really delved into, in much more detail, corporate bonds and the credit premium associated with corporate bonds, which obviously is in itself a very substantial asset class.
Tim, can I ask you to pick out a couple of the standout learnings or, I don't know, maybe slightly surprising takeaways from this year's edition, particularly if we look to the US, perhaps?
A considerable component of the yearbook is very much trying to use history to shine a bright light upon, you know, topics of the day for investors. And it will have escaped very few people's attention that there is a huge amount of narrative at the moment around a very concentrated, relatively small number of household names that have dominated US equity market performance over recent times. And so it's then very fascinating when you look at two things, one which perhaps will surprise, one perhaps less so. So as I've already mentioned, the perhaps less surprising component is that, you know, the US has enjoyed incredible strength in performance in markets, as we know, over recent times. And you have to go back to the early 1970s for the US to account for such a substantial portion of global equity market cap as we see today. So that's probably well appreciated. But certainly in terms of some of the coverage and some of the focus we've had and the questions we've had since the publication of the yearbook, what's perhaps surprised is that actually relative to other markets, the US itself within the market isn't as concentrated as many other locations. So the top 10 companies in the US do account for somewhere in the order of 20% of the US market. But as I say, in a global context, that isn't actually that concentrated. So a couple of things running counter to each other there.
Yeah, and at the risk of asking you a facile question, I suppose, really, Tim, it's interesting that taking a long-term perspective on these things really matters. And you open things up by talking about, you know, the 25th year, which is an impressive run in and of itself. But this idea of
if you want to better appreciate, you know, the laws of risks and returns, you have to try and calibrate on a longer term perspective. Again, that's a sort of second point that you highlighted, and it's always a sensible one to keep front of mind, isn't it?
I think many of us could be forgiven for defining long run in a sort of shorter window than our professors would do here. So, you know, whilst it's probably reasonable to assume that a career in finance may last three, perhaps four decades, you know, some of the work that the professors would sort of centre in upon, you know, might require you to think about things over a longer period of time, which obviously we don't somehow to some degree in the course of a natural career have the opportunity to do. But, you know, what's clearly apparent is that some of the dynamics at play in markets in the last, say, 15 years post-crisis have had characteristics associated with them that have been very abnormal relative to long-run history, and therefore extrapolating from those periods of time can obviously be fraught with potential difficulty.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the inflationary environment, Tim. Also, interest rates, of course. It's been such a narrative for the last, well, for quite a stretch of time. It's often a theme on this programme when I talk to colleagues from all across the bank. It's interesting, isn't it? I guess, how does the yearbook speak to that narrative backdrop?
It's certainly the opportunity to look very carefully at how different asset classes perform against the backdrop of different inflationary environments, and also with regards to how those same asset classes perform against different rate environments, whether rate hiking cycles or cutting cycles. The work around inflation has, you know, has been a particular focus, not just in the yearbook this time around, but naturally within, you know, the sort of last couple of editions. And I think the most important conclusion from the work there is that equities are sometimes referred to as a hedge against inflation. Now, the work of the professors would demonstrate that's not really the case. It's very, very much the case that you will enjoy, you should enjoy good returns on equities that can beat inflation, but that isn't necessarily the same as being a hedge against inflation. So again, the work there demonstrating that, you know, there is that sort of idiosyncratic characteristic to those relationships has certainly been of interest to investors and readers of the yearbook in recent times. And then, as you refer to, I guess we're perhaps sort of coming up upon one of the most, you know, widely anticipated rate cutting cycles. Obviously, we've yet to see the first moves, but it will come as no surprise, I guess, when we do. And again, therefore, the yearbook is useful in being able to, again, provide that historic context as to how asset classes perform in different circumstances. And certainly it's the case that the vast majority of equity returns have been generated in points in the past when we've been going through a rate cutting cycle.
Tim Ramskill. Well, next up, let's hear from Paul Marsh, Professor of Finance at London Business School. Paul, a very warm welcome. It's a real privilege to chat to you on this week's show. The Global Investment Returns Yearbook. Let's talk about this resource, first of all. It's in its 25th year. It is one of the definitive, if not the authoritative guide on long-run returns, historical long-run returns. Just set that scene for us, first of all, Paul. I mean, it seems a facile question, but explain to us why this is such a critical endeavour. There's so much anecdotal evidence about the merit of looking back to look forward, but just remind us, if you like, underscore why fundamentally this yearbook is such a useful resource.
When you're looking at investment returns, you need very long periods of time to make any sensible statements about them. And that's because returns are very, very volatile. A lot of people think the long run is 20 years or 30 years, but over a 20 or 30 year period, you can get very unusual returns on stocks or bonds and so on. And so you really need to go back as far as you can. We've gone back to 1900. We've got 23 countries that we track back to 1900 for stocks, bonds, inflation, currencies, cash, bills, and so on. We also have another dozen or so countries which start later, where we've got 50 to 70 years of history. And you really need that depth of history if you're going to make any statements about risk and return.
Let's set the context, I suppose, for this year's edition, Paul. And I suppose one thing that's important to mention is, I guess we're moving slightly out of this very inflationary environment, a high interest rate environment, and we're sort of heading to normal. And I use quote marks as I say that. Is that, I don't know, in terms of frames of reference at the outset, when you begin to put each year's edition together, I guess you have to be mindful of some of the prevailing circumstances. Are those a couple of the key things to mention that provide the sort of critical backdrop to the 24 edition?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, inflation has been the big issue of the last couple of years. Most people working in finance are actually too young to remember inflation until the last couple of years. The yearbook, though, has a very long memory. And so we have a lot of inflationary periods we can look at. And there's a lot of folklore. People say stocks are a good hedge against inflation. They're not. When inflation is high, stocks do badly, just as bonds do. And so the yearbook is very good for helping people to understand what they can expect when inflation hits, and also what they can expect when people try to cure inflation. I mean, central banks are charged with curing inflation. They do this through hiking cycles, putting up interest rates. We also document in the yearbook what happens during hiking cycles and what happens during easing cycles. And of course, everybody for the last 6 or 9 months at least has been looking forward to interest rates coming down and us entering an easing cycle. So the yearbook is helpful for showing what happens over these different scenarios historically.
Talk to me a bit about diversification, Paul. I know chapter 5 of the piece digs down into risk in more detail. Almost weekly on this programme, we talk about the need for diversification in a balanced portfolio and how that helps to hedge against much risk. Just again, unpack for us a little bit about some of the findings in that chapter in particular. What's the sort of evidence, if you like, that shows the power of diversification, be that across stocks, by geography, by asset class? Because this is we sort of almost refer to that as a given, this need, but it's good to dig down into the evidence that explains exactly why it's a good idea.
Yeah. Jeremy Siegel at Wharton, who wrote a very popular book called Stocks for the Long Run, argued that shares were safe over the long run because in America, there'd never been a period of more than 20 years where you would have lost money in real terms in purchasing power. And he's right. When you look at the US evidence, in fact, he understated it. The longest period when you would have lost money was 16 years. When you look at other countries, that's absolutely not the case. The majority of countries, there have been periods well in excess of 20 years when you would have lost money in real terms. And so that just shows the importance of diversifying across countries, not sticking to your home market. Of course, within your markets, you should also diversify across stocks. And there's lots of evidence that shows how rapidly diversification reduces your risk. So you need to reduce across stocks, you reduce risk by diversifying across countries, and you also need to reduce risk by diversifying across asset classes. So blending stocks and bonds helps to reduce risk and has done so very effectively over the years. So diversification, loads of evidence that this is a way of reducing risk. Of course, if you can reduce risk, then that's effectively the same as increasing expected return, because you can simply take more risk to leverage up your return if you can lower the risk in the first place. So diversification is one of the huge messages of long-run returns.
Well, let's leaf forward a few chapters, Paul, because I did want to ask you about the sort of focus chapter, if you like. This was something that Tim Ramskill mentioned briefly before. Chapter 9, this focus on corporate bonds and the credit premium. Just, I guess take a step back a little bit and talk about how you and your colleagues train a lens on this area. Well, why and how did that particular undertaking unfold for this year's edition?
Partly because it's a long-run omission on our part. We've not looked at corporate bonds before. It's an important asset class. There's something of the order of 44 trillion of corporate bonds outstanding. That's almost half as much as the outstanding value of equities around the world. So this is an important asset class. We've not looked at it before. We thought it was time to look at it. But also, people are looking more favorably at bonds. After a terrible year for bonds in 2022, when government bonds had their worst year on record, in the US, the UK, Switzerland, developed markets as a whole, that has led to higher yields on bonds. And people are starting to look, have been starting to look over the last 6-12 months at bonds. And if you're looking at bonds, why not look at bonds which offer a higher yield than government bonds, which is corporate bonds? Well, that was the short-term motivation. The long-term motivation is that it's a long-standing omission on our part, not looking at this asset class.
Yeah, intriguing. Tell me a little bit about having then this, you know, 25 years now of these yearbooks, Paul. And I know you sort of, in a later chapter in this year's edition, you effectively summarise the past editions. But talk a little bit about the value of that resource then as it grows, and presumably as it will continue to grow. Because again, we talk about looking back through history, but I guess actually looking back through past editions must also be super instructive. Tell me some of the things that you kind of find. Do you sort of look at things like many writers and you sort of think it reads like someone else has written it almost? Do you have those kind of moments? Or what's that process like of reflecting on the previous 24?
I guess we haven't really done that until now. There were really two prompts for that. One is, it was the 25th anniversary, so you tend to look back. Also, partly it's because we've used to do this yearbook with Credit Suisse, and Credit Suisse, it's now migrated to UBS. We're delighted to be with UBS now. And UBS, of course, brings a large number of new people who are new to the yearbook. And so we wanted to not just present the current edition, but also to tell them something about what we covered in the past. And some of the topics are topics that you don't really want to cover every year, and so they don't find their way into the regular yearbook. But we have covered all sorts of things like housing, real estate, collectibles, looking at the long-run returns from art, from collecting postage stamps, from collecting wine, all sorts of things that people just, it's useful for people to be reminded of this, to be told where they can look to find the past research on it. And that's really what motivated us to do a little bit more reflection on the past this year.
Professor Paul Marsh. Well, finally, let's reflect on what all of this means for investors. Kiran Ganesh is with us once again. Kiran, thanks as always for your time. Look, we've heard about the benefits of looking back to look forward, I guess. So tell me, how do you then leverage all of this history, understanding and interpretation into making good decisions going forward? What does that process look like, Kiran?
Yes, well, I think it validates a lot of the theory that we hear a lot about in financial markets in reality. So when we look back over those historical time periods, you really see that the laws of risk and return do work. And you see that equities substantially outperform relative to bonds, which substantially outperform relative to cash. So I think the first lesson for private investors is the importance of being invested and staying invested over the longer term, because you can see that this isn't just a feature of the last 10 or 20 years that equities have gone up by more than these other asset classes. This is something that's held for the very long term and really speaks to the importance of being invested over the longer term. And I think the second thing that's really important for private investors to take away from all of this is the importance of diversification. When you look through the study and you look at how some countries have seen very negative events at some points in their history, those things have tended to be localized. And for investors who are diversified globally and diversified across sectors, you know, they've managed to benefit from that long-term appreciation in markets. And it's only those that have been a bit more concentrated that have suffered those severe wealth destructive events. So the importance of diversification really comes out as well very strongly in the study. So, you know, this isn't something very new, but the idea of being invested, staying invested and being diversified, I think is very much validated by what we've seen in this 150 years of history in the study. Looking at history is great because it can also help prevent investors from overthinking. Sometimes in the very short term, people are thinking about, well, how much has got priced in, and those comments from the Fed and all that's now in the market, a lot of these shorter term considerations. But when you look at the longer term history, you see the intuition really clearly in the data, which is that when central banks are cutting interest rates, that's good for both equities and bonds. And when inflation is low, that's good for both equities and bonds. And when central banks are hiking, that's bad for equities and bonds. And when inflation's high, that's bad for equities and bonds. And this is exactly the intuition, but you see it really clearly and very powerfully in that longer term data. And I think that, you know, following that in your investment strategy can help improve returns over time. And with the Fed now likely to start cutting interest rates quite soon, with inflation now coming under control, and this makes it a particularly important time to be you know, staying invested in equities and bonds, and that's really borne out in the longer term data.
Long run projected returns on stocks and bonds are a couple of percentage points higher than just 2 years ago. Again, perhaps this is what we might have expected to see. But again, when you look at the cold data, it does make quite striking reading.
Yes, and of course, the long run path that isn't on projections is often very smooth. But the reality is, of course, that it moves very sharply around that path. And I think what we'd seen in 2021 was a very sharp run up in equities and bonds. Still had very, very low yield. So the valuations were kind of above what would be expected on the longer term path. So I think it's understandable that now that those have corrected and that we've got slightly higher longer term return projections. And I think that's good news for investors. You know, I think I can remember just a few years ago, kind of questions about where can I find return felt very real because interest rates were basically zero and equity valuations felt very high. Now, you know, we've got interest rates at a much more appealing level, so it's relatively easy to find return in the bond markets. And in equities, we have a really compelling growth story with things like artificial intelligence, which is, you know, leading to a lot of excitement about the longer term returns that equities can provide and what we might get from higher productivity in the economy. So, you know, I think it's certainly a much more compelling environment for investors today. And I think we can all be thankful that those questions of where can I find return have started to ebb away, and it's a bit easier to find return in this now higher return world.
Kiran Ganesh. And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Bulletin with UBS. You can listen again and explore more at monocle.com. That's where you can also join the club and subscribe to Monocle Magazine. You can always follow this program wherever you get your audio, and you can discover more and find out how UBS can help you by heading over to ubs.com. This is The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.